Welcome to Transformers, the podcast about how business people and policymakers are creating a sustainable future. I'm your host, Kai Embren. Today I'm joined by Margot Wallström, former Swedish Foreign Minister and EU Environment Commissioner, and Mattias Wikström, CEO of climate tech firm Doconomy. We are looking at the link between war and the environment and asking whether Europe can lead in building a greener, smarter military. If global militaries were a country, they have been the fourth largest emitter. In a time of rising conflict and climate risk, Europe's fossil fuel dependence is a threat on both fronts. Can renewables make defense stronger and the planet safer? Welcome, Margot and Mattias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Margot, Europe is increasingly understanding the importance of integrating climate and environmental consideration into security and defense strategies. How do you see the EU's role involving in greening the military sector, and what strategic motivation are driving the shift?
I don't know if I can agree with you that this is happening increasingly, that there is a kind of general understanding of the need to green also the military investments and so on. I hope you're right, but I fear that there is too much of a rather short-sighted and one-eyed investment in the militarization, you might say. And this is where all our money is going at the moment. And to me, it appears rather blind. And I just listened to the Swedish news where these heavy investments that we are making at the moment, but instead, they tend to move in that direction where they say, well, we must change the laws and the rules about taking care of the environment because we cannot afford that right now. We just have to, it has to happen much quicker, and we cannot make these impact assessments like before. So I fear that that's a victim instead. The environment becomes a victim of the militarization. But I know and I hope you're right that this is also a kind of a movement and a shift in some quarters to realize that it is necessary to ensure that these investments are also kind of sustainable as much as possible. But the whole, I worry about this bigger picture of having this one-sided, almost blind investment in military equipment and not so much in what used to be the first line of defense, that is the political and diplomatic tools and instruments that we have as well. And also that even, you know, inventing new methods for defensive measures. And instead, countries are saying that we should break the conventions on a ban on anti-personnel landmines. They want to sort of restarting, reusing those methods. And that sounds just so crazy. Aren't we more innovative than that? To be able to come up with other sort of defense ideas. There is no sort of transparent, open debate about these things either. I mean, we know very little about the military investments. We just tend to sort of trust what they are saying, that the military threats are green, that we have to invest in a better defense, so we accept that. But, you know, how this is being done, very few people are engaged in that kind of detailed and very important debate. But I still have my hopes attached to what the European Union is doing, because I think with the whole sort of Green Deal and all of that, that was just an amazing step and an amazing decision that the European Union has taken. And let's hope that the extreme right cannot take it back or change course.
Building on Margot's insights about policy and strategy, Matthias, where you are in the forefront of technology innovation, and how do you see the transition to a green military technology?
I think what Margot is saying is a very well-defined definition of the current state of things. But there's two things that I would like to dwell on. One was Margot's hope for a change in some quarters, in some segments. And I think that in order to see that change, we also need to redefine what is safety and what is military and what is power today. And what I mean by that is the green transition in energy. So for example, I think now more than maybe for five years ago, a well-distributed renewable energy source to any country is the equivalent of a military investment, I would say, because you need to power your country. And if I just take a very absurd example, but if there is a headline saying there is an attack on Ukraine, that's a horrible headline. If there is a headline saying there is an attack on a Ukraine nuclear power plant, I'd say that's even just that little bit worse, right? So not only can we see to military to accelerate the transition, we also need to redefine what is safety. And I think by redefining that, we will find more hope. I think we will see intersectional components coming into play out of an infrastructure perspective. And this is hopeful, I think, because the energy transition is actually doing quite well. And I think if that were to be considered one of strong defense, of safety, of independence, and of resilience, then I think military has really brought something good into the mix. But Margot also brought another topic to the table that I think is also extremely interesting and important, and that is transparency. So in fairness, we don't have any metrics today for what the impact is of the military powers. And you alluded to this in the opening statement, Kai. I think that there is very few countries that actually report on military as a contribution to their carbon emissions and overall carbon footprint according to the UNFCCC and the Paris Accord. So I think it's difficult to know. And when we know, and it's around 5%, right?
I think it's in nature that the 2022, that they found out that only 10 of the armed forces across the 27 members of the EU see the needs of greenhouse gas mitigation, with only 7 having set explicit targets.
Yeah, and I think that changes even more under pressure. So we can, of course, agree that it's important to calculate the greenhouse gas emissions for any activity, and military being one of those that we invest in out of a GDP perspective, I think it's quite substantial numbers. And as we all know, now we also have a populist perspective on increasing those numbers specifically in Europe. But I think that those numbers are also when military is not in play. So there is one carbon emissions consequence of military. There's another carbon emissions consequence of conflict and war. And I believe that it has been calculated that so far the Russia's attack and war on Ukraine is the equivalent of 3 to 4 mid-sized countries even per year. And we must remember that the transparency in these numbers are missing. So it's really a guessing game. And if you step away from that guessing game and look at it out of a more philosophical perspective, one can argue, can we even reach the transition targets that we need to see if we are so preoccupied with killing each other off?
I think that was an amazing intervention, because also I've had the privilege and honor to actually work with the president's office in Ukraine, with President Zelensky's office. And we have put together a report, and we had 3 tasks. We were supposed to assess the environmental damage of the war. We were supposed to look at the accountability issue. They want Russia supposed to pay for these kind of war crimes. And thirdly, we were also supposed to come up with ideas about how to rebuild and reconstruct also Ukraine. And to make it a priority, you know, in the midst of war, to talk about the environment and the impact of the war on the environment is just totally historically unique and very, very important. And one of the issues that we actually also, of course, had to look at was exactly what you started by saying, Matthias, and that had to do with the attacks on nuclear facilities and the nuclear plants. And as you know, the Russians started by occupying Chernobyl and left it in disarray and, you know, with even more damage to that place and now also Zaporizhia. And of course, we understand that this potentially could be an enormous and even worse disaster than what we're seeing. And they also have calculated and tried to put figures and numbers and in terms of money to everything, all of these damages to the country, including also what kind of impact this has on the greenhouse gas emissions and on climate change. And you're right, saying that they looked at Belgium, for example. So as much as Belgium emits also comes from the war itself. So this is so important, and this very rarely is being discussed in open. And the same goes for another aspect of militarization, which has to do with corruption, money disappearing in the whole world and business that has to do with weapons and militarization. So this is like the third biggest sector when it comes to corruption as well. And nobody wants to mention that in the context, because now they need all our support to just sort of use the budgetary means to produce and buy more weapons. Mm. So it's a difficult time.
I think you're bringing once again a very important point, Margot, and that is the trust component. And this is going to sound very, very rude, but and of course everyone that dies or are wounded in conflict, this is a tragedy, but potentially it's not the loss of human life that is the greatest complication of wars in modern day. It is probably the loss of trust in each other, that we can work together to resolve this tremendous challenge that we are facing in regards to the climate crisis, and trust in the institutions and the systems facilitating progress based on that said trust. And corruption obviously being an additional factor that comes into play. And I just want to reiterate, obviously every life lost is one life too many. But out of a structural perspective and a systemic perspective, the trust in each other and the trust in the counterparty, the trust in the institution that facilitates progress is potentially in another way an even greater loss.
So the truth and the trust are among the first victims of war, as is being said. That's true. It's not only the truth, but also the trust is being lost.
What we see is the need for collaboration. We see the intersectionality. I think we're beginning to see that in Sweden, actually, with the different institutions working closely together out of a resilience perspective, energy perspective, distribution perspective, and so forth. And we also see a spillover effect on innovation. So a lot of the innovation coming out of the Second World War benefited Sweden out of an engineering perspective, where we were, for many different reasons, able to propel our nation's economy forward off the back of engineering skills that we could monetize, that no other country could monetize at the same speed that we could do in Sweden. And we've seen a great number of very ambitious companies coming out of that, such as Saab, Scania. We're looking at LME Ericsson and many others for that matter. And that technology has serviced not only Sweden well, but globally it has serviced us well. So to put it to an extreme, would we have had Bluetooth today if we had not had the Second World War and the learnings from that? I don't know. But of course, we would have liked not to have the Second World War at all. But there is under pressure a lot of innovation, a lot of funding going into innovation, albeit quite non-transparent. But there is a lot of competition around the upper edge in any competition. And if you look at war as a competition, innovation and the secret skills of any nation could easily be transferred into a company, and that could be a competitive advantage in a global marketplace. Mm. And I think that's what we see with venture capital as well now, trying to redefine impact and sustainability investments, moving from what we collectively before believed to be a more sustainable tomorrow on a traditional perspective, and now looking at investing in components that one could at best try to fit into an impact investment mold.
Nigel, you mentioned also the role of the Green Deal, that is something that could be used for developing in some of the direction to drive change. But yeah, and considering the technology advance that Matthias mentioned, what policy or reforms are needed with the EU and NATO to accelerate adaptation of green defense practice?
I mean, what they say here and what I hear in my own country, since we are the newest member of NATO, is that, all right, you will have to now think about the transport policy. You have to improve the quality of your roads and railways and what have you. And of course, most people would say, so it took a NATO membership to actually get the government to accept that the roads have to be improved and the railways and the trains have to move on time and so on. But this is true for a number of services and also our whole understanding of the need to be prepared or to like keep fresh water or cash or whatever have you to a stash of that in your basement in case of crisis. So the crisis awareness, of course, has been has come to life in this country as well. But I really, as I said, I take any good news that I can get these days. And what Matthias said about the attempts to the all the efforts to create policies that are really consciously moving in the direction of making it more sustainable and understanding this bigger picture, I think that's what we have to put our hopes to.
When we see the numbers of money that will be on the table for defense in the coming days, then you wonder if our nation not are prepared to measure the greenhouse gases, and the investment may not go for a greener military.
No, but this is not discussed in the bigger media debate about NATO or militarization. I don't see a lot of those arguments being presented. And this is the thing. I don't know if it has to do with the fact that also political debate is being polarized in a way that it's either or. It's one side or the other side. There is very little compromise or a real discussion or cooperation. And this that's the thing, that we are very one-sided, and then it's really about what I mentioned at the beginning, the short term versus the long term, because if we one day, hopefully soon, will reach peace, what do we have then? What are we left with if we don't also invest in the sort of political and diplomatic methods that will keep peace, that will make it possible for us to start to live together? So it is really a mindset that has to change, and also the practical policies that will have to go with it.
I completely agree with Margot in the sense that we need to get better at creating peace that does not generate new wars. So we're looking at Gaza and Ukraine, and we can, of course, backtrack that into other conflicts over the history of mankind. So we need to be better at creating lasting peace. That's one thing, but I think on that we can all agree. What I think is fundamentally challenging to me is that I had a conversation working at Economy. We tried to bring transparency bottom up so that every individual, every citizen, coming back to the Green Deal and Frans Timmermans' four pillars. So one pillar is citizen activation. For us, citizen activation is a lot about knowing cause and effect, knowing the consequences of your action, and an educated citizen is likely to consume better decisions from their political leaders as well. So to me, it all comes together. But on that transparency side, I had a conversation with Christophus, the CEO of Climeworks. And Climeworks is a direct air carbon capturing company that sucks CO2 emissions out of the atmosphere. Now, that sounds like, you know, magic. But we concluded, and I don't have, this was a few years ago and I don't have the exact numbers, but we concluded that at a cost of $720 per metric ton extracted from the air and put into the ground, it would be approximately half of the military spending on global GDP for that cost per metric ton over a period of, I think it was 10 years, to completely. And this, I know it, we should be careful with saying that it's possible, but to completely de-risk the climate crisis out of a CO2 emissions perspective. Now we face other crises as well, past the crisis and biodiversity loss and so forth. But if we have the price for it, we have the metrics for this change, and still we're not doing it. So my hope, and to your comment on my article, Kai, my hope is that we will see technology, both hardware and software, developed in order to protect life directly from a threat from another human, into also protecting us as a community from the problem that we have created with the climate crisis. We just need to prioritize it in the right way. And that's where I'm a little bit challenged. We have the technology. Some of it is early days and some of it is mature, but we have the technology to mitigate the mess that we have created. We have the data points. We have the data points that we need to see in order to make substantiate the decisions out of a data perspective and also track and measure or progress. So if we have the tech and we have the data, the only thing missing is leadership. And until leadership is in place, there is no tech or data in the world that is going to resolve this.
You know, with everything, you need political leadership. People who say are willing to take some flack for saying this or for introducing this policy or even presenting this idea. But this is where hope lies. And I think it lies also in a young generation that are the better educated, that are willing to try new things and they want to live. They want to live. And this is where we are at the moment. We risk our lives and the life of this planet unless we do something. And it's urgent. So we are running out of time, but we can still do it. And we have all the tools available to us if we just use them in the right way.
But to wrap up this, if there is one piece of advice or insights you like to say when you talk about policymakers, military leaders, and the general public to take away from today's discussion about Europe's journey towards a more sustainable and secure future, what would it be?
I am going down going back to the very basic things. I use children as your measuring stick. Think about children. What can I do to improve life for children, my own children or grandchildren? Because that was what actually also motivated, like, my parents, who were rather poor. And they said, we are willing to make those sacrifices, to work very hard, because we want something better for you. And what if we would bring children into the picture when we think about investments today and how this will affect them? But of course, I also believe that if you are a political leader, you need to have an agenda. You need to set your own priorities, and you have to work very hard to achieve that, because it makes you accountable as well. If you say that this is what you will recognize me for doing, this is what I want to add to the picture. And we have to keep hope alive, you know, like in the poem, hope is that thing with feathers that perches in your soul. And what is it? Sings a song without the words and never stops at all.
What Margot is calling agenda, I call a narrative. I think when a narrative is missing for the general public, when the story of our time is missing, there will be a lot of different outliers being opportunistic around creating very egocentric agendas and very egocentric narratives that only plays to the lesser sides of our personas. I think when we as mankind step up for each other, that's when we can create not only change in the direct short term, but also over time. And I think that narrative and the agenda for the political landscape, or the narrative for the commercial landscape today, unfortunately, is missing. And we need stronger voices for that. But I agree, the seven generation kind of principle for decision making would have not put us in this mess to begin with. So obviously there is lots to learn. I just hope that we will have the time frame it calls for to learn fast enough. And when I look at I'm coming out of my daughter graduated from high school yesterday, my son graduated from secondary school today. And when I see the energy and the bounce, you know, in their steps and their commitment and engagement to world topics, that was far more intense than it ever was when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah.
They really do care. They care because it matters, you know. And I think if you want to know where this world is leading, you should either speak with very old people or with very young people, because everyone in the middle are driven by their vested interests. So if you want to get the best sides out of humanity, speak to a child or an elderly person, draw your own conclusion and support that narrative.
So thank you, Margot and Matthias, for sharing your expertise and thoughts and inspiring us to think about the future of military innovation and climate leadership. For our listeners interested in delving deeper, check out the website kaiemren.org. Be sure to stay tuned in our topics on climate adaptation, in Weathering Tomorrow, climate and methane in the coal mines, and the role of plastic credits to clean up the ocean. Until then, stay informed, stay engaged. Thank you, Margot and Matthias.
Thank you.
I'm Kai Embren. Follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn, where I will be announcing the future guests to this podcast. And you can expect about 2 programs a month. And each guest has a unique story of making business and society sustainable. So find out more. Visit my homepage, kaiembren.org. Thank you for listening.